I'm Stuart Lee, I'm a comedian, and I've got a new book out called Content Provider through Faber and Faber, which is a collection of short pieces I've written in the last 5 years. I'm obliged to provide digital media support for the marketing of this content, and in order to do so, Alan Moore has very kindly agreed to talk to me about this book here in Northampton today.
Why, Stuart? I suppose basically, why have you done this?
Well, over the years, as an E-list celebrity, you get asked to write newspaper columns, mm-hmm. which is unfair, because obviously you're principally being asked because they think, oh, you're a bit known, so it might drive some traffic through.
Yeah.
And if you're any good, that's a bonus, right? And then about 5 or 6 years ago, I suddenly had a bit of a breakthrough on how to do them, which was, in my mind, I thought, I'll try and write as if I'm trying to get sacked, as if this is the last column you'd be asked to do. And I also realised, a bit like I'd done with the stand-up, that had to be some sort of separation between the columnist voice and sort of, you know, who you were. And the columnist had to be someone who had to knock these things out, also wanted to give a good account of himself in some way. And I'll tell you what I was thinking of on some level. I didn't really realise until after it was done. But, you know, years ago, I'd read some Arthur Machen, and you actually enrolled me in the Arthur Machen Society. And there's an interesting thing with Arthur Machen, the Welsh writer of late 19th, early 20th century, that as well as writing these epics, mystical books, and doing his own things that he really cared about, he also knocked out loads of columns for magazines.
Arthur Machen, he also published, I think, a slim volume of his own bad reviews.
Did he? I didn't know that.
I believe
really?
So. So your career is echoing that of Arthur Machen in many ways.
Yeah, well, and dying in sort of forgotten obscurity.
The century is yet young.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, the title Content Provider.
Yeah.
I mean, like, this was a term that I noticed myself a few years ago. And it kind of seems to be implying that the relationship between the artist and the art is kind of like the relationship between pig lips and sausages.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I first noticed it, I was appearing at the Kilkenny Comedy Festival about 10 years ago, and I got a text on my phone out of nowhere asking me if, it said, "Hello, we are a digital content provider, and we wondered if you'd be prepared to provide content for various media off the back of your appearance at Kilkenny." And I couldn't even understand what it was. What I worked out was they wanted me to give them a bit of film of me doing something that could then be put on mobile phones and things. And they described me primarily as a content provider, which I didn't do it because I felt so bruised by the idea of that. But then Henning Venn, the German comedian, is very funny. He's more than that. I mean, he's a comedian in his own right, but he's principally a German comedian. He used to work in football marketing, and he's very funny. He talks about, we're content providers and we have to drive around the country delivering our product to different customer bases. And he reduces the whole process of being a writer or a comedian into this sort of, you know, like, so calling it content provider, it's sort of saying these were done for this purpose.
Yeah,
but what fun could you have with them?
I think that it's a hurtful term, but it's probably accurate.
Yeah. Yeah,
you know, yeah. I mean, at least in culture generally, I think that sort of content provider will probably do.
Yeah, well, in a way, you know, we're encouraged, aren't we, to spend a lot of time talking about, oh, you know, what did you mean by this? Why did you do it? Well, with these, it's because on the Wednesday, they would ask me, what are you writing about? And I had to file them by Friday morning. And then I thought, there's the parameters. It's 1,100 words. What can you do with it? And that's the fun of it, which is probably something you've had with superhero strips, is people know what the rules are. So how can you mess around with it and still, on some level, deliver something that's supposedly a newspaper column, but you've messed about
with it? Well, I would say that probably there's a good case to be made for saying that any kind of genre or any kind of form, it's never more interesting than when you're kind of breaking it in some way or dismantling it.
Yeah.
You know, that's what they're for, really, I think, forms and genres.
Yeah.
They're there to be pulverised.
Well, I suppose there's a set of expectations about what a newspaper column is that you either confirm or deny. One of the ways you deny them is by making up things that aren't true and writing a thing that reads a bit more like a short story, or by expressing an absolutely unsubstantiated opinion which is groundless, or, you know, sort of mess around with it. And also not really writing as yourself, but writing as this other kind of version of it, because the traditional newspaper columnist is someone saying what I did this week and this happened to me and whatever, so try and mess around with it a bit.
Clearly a lot of your readers don't understand. I'm just thinking about the Arthur Machen-like kind of critical comments below the line. I mean, some of them I thought were very astute. I mean,
I agree with some of them. I mean, I've put the comments in.
The one that surprised me, because I know quite a lot about the occult, but the person who pointed out, I'd always thought that the Witchfinder General was Mary Hopkin. I thought that Matthew Hopkins was the guy who'd done the backing vocals on Sound and Vision. Some of your audience's comments, it's obviously a different audience to your stand-up.
Well, that's the fun of it, is it goes out to all these people, and then you sort of... part of the fun of writing columns for the newspapers, you think people sort of stumble across this in the middle of all this other stuff, and what will they think of it? And it's the element of surprise. Also, there's a lot more sort of scatology and stuff about, and sort of just filth in these, than I would do in the stand-up. Because I like the idea that on a Sunday morning, someone's just stumbled across an article about a turd that has the face of Tony Blair, and they've read it at 9 o'clock in the morning and go, what's that? You know, so it's actually about...
You'd expect concept. That in a club, in a comedy club at 11 o'clock at night, but not with your copy of The Observer in the morning.
Yeah, so in a way, I do things in these that I think are a bit sort of pathetic, but I think it's funny that they're in the newspaper. And the other thing that you can't escape, I mean, I admire your decision to entirely sort of cut yourself off from social media, and I've sort of done it a bit, but not quite enough. And what I've found is that, you know, in newspapers now, there's always below the line comments, and in a way, what started to happen was the sheer level of hostility of some of them. I started to write more to become the kind of person that would generate this incomprehensible fury. I mean, I wrote, there was a comment from Tim Montgomery, who's a sort of conservative blogger, saying at the end of one, he wrote about it somewhere and put, the Guardian is now beyond parody, because the column was meant as a joke. You know, and so it's sort of, it kind of lands in different places, and so the responses you get from it are, they haven't come to see you in a club, they're not your audience. So, but on the other hand, you also get people that don't know who you are that really like it. So
I would think that sort of a lot of the readers posting these comments, particularly the hostile ones, do you think that they're frightened in some way because they have mistaken these pieces for journalism?
Well, you have to know what is acceptable context. Like last year, there'd been a big anti-capitalist riot in London. Where it was and who'd been targeted, but the police were involved in quite a big event. And the next day I was dropping the kids off in school, and one of the mums in the playground said to me, "Oh, you look tired." And I went, "Well, I was on that riot last night, setting fire to all banks and things, and I've got arrested, and it was a long evening." And she went, "Oh." She went, "Well," she said, "I would be against capitalism, but I have a sort of stake in it, I suppose." I thought, wow, I've kind of like really misjudged this. Because people don't know you, do they? So they don't know what you're saying, you know, and they don't know if that's true, and it's the same with these. They sort of go out into a vacuum, so in a way it's unfair. What is interesting about below the line comments is a lot of them are systematically organised. I wrote a column, isn't actually in here, it was about a giant model of Putin, of a naked Putin flying around and landing in different places to intimidate people. And afterwards I realised that a lot of the comments were sort of clearly been systematically generated from somewhere. And then my cousin, who is married to a Russian, he said, "Oh, well, the Kremlin have a unit that is like a cyber unit that attempt to shape discussion by planting things." So the next time I mentioned Russia, I deliberately wrote a paragraph that made no sense whatsoever, to see what would happen on it, because it generated these really odd things where the
criticisms sort of, yes, of your point of view.
Yeah, but from people in the Kremlin, but they couldn't quite work out what had been said. But then another thing, I wrote a thing about the Chinese coming, and when the Chinese business delegate came to meet the government, and then it was in the form of a massive Chinese arse that was being rolled around London. And one of the comments was a sort of 300-word kind of hagiography of the current leader of China about his background and why it was wrong to criticise him because he'd been raised in... So you know that there are... You kind of think it's funny, but there are actually people out there that, even a silly little column, there are totalitarian governments generating content to put underneath it. So of course they would have hacked the Democrat Party's emails if they're doing it to the stupid Joe column.
Yeah, you know? With some of the comments, with the reaction of the Russian and Chinese governments, with the reaction of this other mum at the school gates.
Yeah.
Is it that people these days, they really need an emoji that you're not being told?
I don't know,
serious?
Although to be fair, you know, things have been said, haven't they, in the current American election campaign, in the Brexit campaign, that were much more extreme than things that we used to see in discourse. You know, columns were written in newspapers, like by, you know, usually on the right, to be fair, by Katie Hopkins types, generating opinions, supposedly comic on some level, that you just never really thought you'd hear. So, I wrote, one of my regrets, and I left it in, was around the time of the Scottish independence debate, I noticed that there were a lot of columns written by English columnists saying what they thought the Scots should do. And they felt they were entitled to opinion because their gran was Scots, or they used to go on holiday there a lot as a kid, you know. And so I wrote a thing saying that because I thought I had a Scottish ancestry, I should be allowed to say, you know, what would happen. And I thought it was so over the top that it was obviously a parody of those sort of columns, but it wasn't. And I actually got the hate mail for that spread out beyond the below-the-line comments, and people were leaving things for me at theatres. And I didn't really want to upset that. I upset the wrong people by accident. But then they can be forgiven for thinking that because there were loads of columns like that. You know, that's the problem, is how do you... Okay, what my son, who recently learned the word dystopia, was saying to me, how would you write a sort of dystopian fiction as we head towards one? And certainly your dystopias seem to have anticipated, you know, rather more quickly than one might have hoped.
It wasn't my intention that things should work out like this. I wasn't laying down a blueprint, but it seems that that is what it has been misunderstood as. You know, it's... one of the points that I wanted to make about the book was the last piece in it.
Oh, yeah.
The piece about wolf people.
Oh, yeah.
And their third album, Fine.
Yeah.
Now I've since listened to this.
Oh, right.
And it's a wonderful album.
Oh, right.
It's wonderful. And it's a very good review.
Right.
But, I mean, placed at the end of a lot of deliberately misleading drivel, I suppose.
Yeah,
Were you at... My initial response, I told a lot of people that the band Wolf People didn't exist.
Right.
That you just made them up as some kind of ironic joke. It's...
Well, I put it in at the end because I used to write lots of record reviews, and I don't anymore. And I put it in at the end just to show some other kind of thing that I did, and because I liked that record and I liked them. And I kind of thought, after all this confusion where the meaning wasn't quite clear and the tone of voice wasn't quite clear, I just put a thing in at the end, almost like a palate cleanser at the end of the meal. Here's a fairly straightforward thing about something that I liked.
You have to admit that in the context of the rest of the book, it is going to look like...
They're not real at all. Yeah, well, that hadn't occurred to me, to be honest.
I've listened to the stuff, that does them a great disservice. Okay. You know?
I did that for you. I mean, I wrote a thing for your magazine about the Super Moby Dick of Space. There's a Legion of Superheroes comic from the 60s where there's a giant whale in space, the Super Moby Dick of Space, and I'd always sort of, I'd read that somewhere as a kid, or seen it and sort of forgotten about it. And I wasn't sure that, I thought I must have imagined it as Super Moby Dick of Space. And I was talking to you about it 10, 15 years ago. And I just mentioned it and you knew all about it.
I knew it existed.
The Super Moby Dick of Space. And then I thought, well, basically for your magazine, I wrote a sort of false history of the Super Moby Dick of Space, but put enough detail in it to make people think that it must have had its own series and whatever. And
you actually, I think, suggested that it had perhaps originally been inspired by some notes left by Herman Melville.
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah.
That
yeah.
suggested a sequel to his novel Moby Dick, which would be actually taking part in space.
In space, yeah. You know, like, again, that was a help in getting to these sorts of things, trying to write something. Again, I didn't really think about it till recently, but as a precocious teenager, my friend Stuart Ray encouraged me to read Borges, you know, and a lot of those short stories, they're not really a short story, they're a description of imaginary but plausible sounding facts about a piece that he might have written had he got round to doing it. And a lot of those have that flavour to them, like the, you know, with this one about, is Grant Shapps an alien, right? Grant Shapps, the former Tory party, and I just found out loads and loads of true facts about Grant Shapps, and the more I found out, the more implausible he seemed to become. One of the true facts about him was that he had a road accident in America and ended up in a hospital run by McDonald's, right? And he was in, and he says, and he wrote, he did a serious interview with a newspaper in Bedford saying that whenever he saw a McDonald's clown, he felt really happy because it made him remember how lucky he was to survive this road accident, and that the accident he had was in a sort of UFO abduction hotspot, which again I thought was... So basically what I did, I cast around for enough mad things that are true and then try and triangulate this other story off the back of it. And with people like Gove, the stories, the true things about him are often so mad. But, I mean, I've been writing for years about how I was one of the hack writers on this terrible stand-up comedy programme that he used to be on, called Stab in the Dark.
You mentioned that quite a few times.
And, I know, and it's just come out as a story now off the back of Brexit. But I used to mention, I think people thought it was made up. And that also, by a weird coincidence, I was published in an anthology of teenagers' poetry that he was also in about 1982, where he wrote this really odd poem about resenting all the sort of posh rugby lads for having power and wealth and girls, and that one day people would sort of see that he was best, right? And it kind of, that sort
it's
of...
a whole what, narrative there,
I know.
Isn't it?
And yeah. I wrote about this, and so you get those two facts and then you make up a third one, you know. But I think the true things that I found out were so odd. And the other weird thing about that is how, you know, I wish I'd brought this out a month later and had run it up to the point of the vote, for the Europe vote, because obviously the whole pantheon of personalities has changed, and this is already feels like ultra short term nostalgia. I remember Michael Gove.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, like, your the number of references to George Osborne.
Yeah,
I just about remember who he was.
Yeah,
I mean, he was the Chancellor. But at the moment, everything is so fleeting, so ephemeral.
Yeah.
That, I mean, things don't really stand still long enough to satirise.
Well, it's been difficult. It's August now, and obviously in July, June, normally that's when your new Edinburgh show as a stand-up starts to come together. And I'm not alone. And a lot of people have felt it's in free fall because someone gets a job, and you think, well, I'll use that as part of the story. And then it's gone. You know, 2 days later, they're not in that job anymore. I mean, the weird thing about this is it's accidentally... It accidentally seems more coherent than it is as a collection of columns, because it's a collection of columns about people, many of whom have now disappeared from public life, or ways of thought and values which the power shift, rightly or wrongly, in the exit from Europe, will relegate, you know, to the back of the line. I mean, arguments about what's the point of culture, welfare cuts, all these sort of things are just steamrolled along, aren't they, in the bigger thing now, which is how we're going to pay to get out of Europe and who's going to organise it and whatever. All those things are just gone into the mill. It seems like, you know, to write 1,100 words about the point of public broadcasting. Kind of seems like this awful period, 2011 to 2016, now looks like a golden age before we plunged into sort of administrative chaos.
How it's going to look, isn't it, to the future? It's going to look like, you deliberately planned this to sort of to capture the decline of this pinnacle of civilization.
Yeah.
It's not so much what the story's about, but the very fact of the story's existence actually makes you think about the world that you're living in.
Yeah.
And whether that could apply or not.
Yeah.
So you're going on about the dead cat in the road outside your house in Hackney, and how
actually that was a good one. That was, I mean, not the it was at the end of the Olympics. There was all this talk about the legacy of the Olympics. You know, mm-hmm. The tragedy is 5 years down the line. I mean, that whole celebration of Britishness as a sense of the community that was the opening ceremony, that's just shot to pieces now, and it didn't have any effect on encouraging people to do sport, didn't create greater access to people for sport. But I wrote a thing where I basically got all the reports on the legacy of the Olympics and how brilliant it was, and changed it to being a discussion about a decomposing cat in my road and all the people standing around looking at it, and I thought it was fairly obvious.
And the stain that would endure for decades or centuries.
But this is what I got from the public. You see, when a supposedly respected, famous, open inverted commas, comedian, they always do that as if putting inverted commas on it suggests that you are, right? Such as yourself, resorts to writing about a dead animal on the pavement, pretending it is amused and fascinated community, I can only feel sorry for you. Clearly, the cat should have been removed and not left on the pavement. If you find all this amusing, you're a poor specimen of a human being. You're not big, you're not clever, you're just pathetic. You should decide at some point to grow up, and I wish you luck with that. I mean, it's unfair, but they are funny. Weirdly, I felt really bad about that column. I wrote that column, and I hadn't really realised. I worry that I'm not really fit to do these, because I don't really... I'm aware that I don't really understand the public mood. And the Olympics, to me, I always thought, OK, how long is this going to last? What's going on? Why have we done deals with all these dodgy companies? What's Boris trying to get out of it, you know? And after I wrote that column making fun of it, you know, again, my point of contact with the world, school playground at pick-up and drop-off time, I could see some of the mums that had worked as volunteer guides or whatever, a lot of people did in East London, I could see they were upset with me because they'd worked on something they really believed in, and they didn't want to see it compared to a decomposing cat. And you know, I did feel bad about it, and you know,
it becomes more of a problem. I think that I don't think there's any real narrative in society for people to actually have a grasp upon what is actually reality.
Yeah.
And I think that some people do get angered and upset if you're playing around with that. I'm sure that probably Boyes had people who were really, really irritated by him.
Yeah.
But of course, he didn't have underlying comments.
No, he didn't. Imagine if he had.
Labyrinths would have been a completely different experience.
He would have written them himself, though, wouldn't he? And under all different personalities, you know, commenting on himself.
I bet he... have you done that, Stuart?
I haven't, but I sort of feel I don't have to, because I feel
that
I can create I can make the response that I want to happen. I can write a thing, right, and I know what kind of below the line comment it will provoke, and I know how funny other people will find that. So in a way, it's sort of like a bit like what you do in stand up, where you can say a thing, and it's like a misdirection, and you know an audience will believe a certain thing, then you can come back and muck around with it later on.
So in a way, you were expecting that accusation of, well, I suppose animal cruelty or heartlessness at the very least.
Well, not that one. There's certain buzzwords that you know you can sort of trigger. Like if you mention any religion, or pretty much anything now. Mm-hmm. Like you could write an article making fun of ice cream, right, and how ice cream isn't very nice. And at the bottom, someone would put, "Well done for making fun of ice cream. I look forward to your attack on Islam with bated breath." People will always put Something like that. And then their avatar will be like a Union Jack or something when they're called True Patriot or something.
You know? Yeah.
But it's sort of like they're, you know, they're, you can sort of have fun with it. And I wrote a thing in one of the columns. I talk about, we're trying to figure out, me and the other radical artists, we're trying to figure out what we think about Jeremy Hunt or something. And so I attended a meeting with my fellow radical artists in a squatted tower block in East London where we ate lentils and whatever. And someone was like, put that in the comment and put, the long winter evenings must fly by. As if I've actually... But you sort of know that by writing it, this will happen. Right? And so for me, the fun of it partly is, you know, I'm asking people to, what I find funny about it is just it even existing, just putting it there and seeing and thinking how it'll be received. And also how it's not understood. Like I wrote one where I got loads and loads of facts about Thatcher. It took me ages to figure it out. The subtext being that that when she talked about opening the back door for negotiations with the IRA,
I remember
which she does a lot. She's basically, it's a code for a sexual act that Dennis would be allowed to perform with her as a reward for his birthday or something. And I got all the dates to work out. And I had to do a lot of research in where she'd said this and on what days she'd said it. But I also put a few things wrong in it, you know. So I managed to write 1,100 words in a national newspaper without anyone really noticing, saying that Margaret Thatcher's talking about opening the back door for negotiations with the IRA was actually code for a sex act, which was a treat for Dennis Thatcher's birthday. I did it with such detail. So quite, if you don't click with that, it's just boring. A boring article about dates and facts. And at the end, someone's put... the director for Lillia Lloyd must realise that the Iron Lady would surely have earned more than its usual 2 or 3 star reviews. If only she and Glenn Close had shown the courage to bring Thatcher's backdoor negotiations to the silver screen in detail, perhaps in 3D. Then the comment is, when writing an article, please get the smallest of facts straight. That is not Glenn Close portraying Margaret Thatcher, but the wonderful Meryl Streep. So again, like, if someone's read all that and got it, and then they hit that line, it's the fun. I sort of think maybe it came from stand-up, which is where there's something going on in stand-up which isn't the same as prose, in the same way as there's something going on in comic, which is a relationship between the text and the image. In stand-up, you've got this noise that happens in the room that changes the meaning of what you've said. So I suppose maybe I was looking for that, and I've not thought about this until I talk to you now. Maybe I was looking for that with newspaper columns. Could you create this space? Well, it's not really the newspaper column itself, but the thought of it existing in this environment where it's consumed as a newspaper column, and then what happens as it's read or as it's alongside the rest of the newspaper, you know, sort of disruptive influence on it.
Yeah, I mean, I completely say that. I mean, although I think that what I was saying earlier about the fact that reality kind of seems to be broken, and it does make it very difficult to subvert.
Yeah.
If it's already subverted beyond recognition.
Yeah.
That I think it gets to be a problem for everybody. It's not just comedians. It's when you've got an audience potentially who... Well, I mean, we know about the people who write into the characters upon TV shows rather than the actors.
Or beat up the actors in the street because they've been unfaithful to someone in the TV.
Well, a friend of mine, Robert Goodman, because he played a drug dealer on EastEnders.
Yeah.
He got chased down the street by an old woman telling him that they didn't want his drugs around there. It's... I mean, like, people's grip upon reality seems a bit precarious.
Yeah, yeah.
I sometimes wonder if we're doing them a kindness with all of this fiction, or is it just confusing them more?
Well, you know, this is it's now the 1st of August, And I don't know what I don't know. I've got to write another column for a paper in 3 weeks' time. And you know, after the Brexit vote, I don't know what is it you're going to lob over into the pond of public opinion, and what ripples will come back. I don't really know, because I'm not saying leaving Europe was right or wrong. Not, I'd say privately what I think, but this isn't really what it's about. This isn't relevant. What is relevant is that a lot of the stories and opinions that swung the vote were fictions.
Yeah.
Demonstrably. And it doesn't seem to have mattered. And in fact, the post, they're calling it post-truth politics, aren't they, where your Trumps and your Borises don't even go to the trouble now of trying to make the data fit what they want, what people want to hear. They just say what people want to hear, irrespective of whether there's no, you know, expert opinion that will support it. So I don't know what you can write now that is sort of stupid and mad enough to reflect that. And in a way, small mercies, you know, I sort of felt I kind of got to the end of this. I don't really know what to do with it now. And now it's all changed again. Everything's changed again, and I don't know how you start. And also, the perception was as well, wasn't it, that a sort of liberal type, you know, you control everything, you're the dominant
narrative. Oh, the liberal elite. The
liberal elite. Well, they don't, do they, right?
And, I've never met any liberal elitists.
No, so, but now more than ever, that's not true, because the liberal elite didn't get its own way in this last vote. And we know that hate crimes have gone up 500%, and we know that all these sorts of things, off the back of leaving Europe, whether it was right or wrong to leave Europe, we know that there's a knock-on effect with with people's the daily perceptions of things. Yeah. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, what do you write next? There's not really anything ridiculous enough that you can say about Boris. I mean, in here and in the stand-up at the time, you'd say, well, he's a sort of delusional, manipulative liar. Here's why. Here's a funny joke about that. But it's still in power.
Yeah, yeah, it know, does so, tend to take some of the sting out of it. I remember Peter Cook once talking about the Establishment Club and saying, well, this of course, we based our satire very much upon the that of the Weimar Cabaret that did so much to prevent the rise of Hitler.
Yeah. Well, I don't think you imagined. I don't imagine these will change anything. There's some localised areas that I was really interested in personally, like who controls comedy and broadcasting, and sort of the way the government and the culture secretary specifically collude with secondary ticketing agencies to drive prices for tickets up beyond the budget of the average person. Yeah. I mean, I know that. We know that happens, and they won't do anything about it. And I sort of wrote about that. But mainly, I've been criticised, actually, for why don't I write these as coherently as when I do a podcast with someone and talk about things that I understand about politics. And it's because I just feel they're a different thing. They're not a sort of opinion platform or an essay. They're a kind of a semi-fictional bit of literary comedy. You know, and again, it's a different thing. And I'm lucky enough to have other outlets. If I only did one thing, I'd put everything into that. And if I only did, you know, stand-up. But I think, weirdly, it's the newspaper columns of a gentleman amateur. I can always just do some more gigs or do something. And the only thing I don't know, now that the telly series is cancelled, that books and physical media are in collapse, and now that me and the rest of the liberal elite want to save enough money to go and live in Ireland, I don't know if I can afford to be quite as...
Yeah, well, I mean, like, your yeah. strategy, your style of comedy, it's a bit like, I don't know, a kamikaze pilot yeah, yeah. who is relentlessly ploughing into the deck of the aircraft carrier that he's been launched from.
You know, the audience that come and see me live, it's nice. They're secure enough, whatever they're in themselves, whatever their beliefs are, to tend to laugh them off, whether they agree with you or disagree with you. And I do like that about it. And I was very, I mean, again, there's a bit I did in Glasgow about 10 years ago about how William Wallace was a gay paedophile. And the audience, you know, and actually people said, oh, it's really amazingly brave. But actually, it sort of was, and it wasn't. Because even then, the people that were coming to see me were the sort of people that would enjoy being insulted, you know, on some level, because they're not powerless and defensive. You know, they're sort of, on the whole, if they've managed to find you and tolerate it, they're mainly all right.
You kind of have, I mean, in your live shows, and I presume this probably applies to a lot of your writings as well, you've got this kind of, I mean, as long as I've been coming to see you, you have been abusing at least half of the audience, which is obviously, it's a technique. And it's pretty indiscriminate which half you abuse and which half you invite into your circle. Yeah, but so obviously, your audience, even in Glasgow on a Friday night with you accusing William Wallace of being a paedophile.
Yeah,
I mean, they're your audience still.
Yeah.
So I mean, they're going to know. They're going to be coming to see you for a reason.
To be abused on some level. I think it's also that increasingly I sort of feel like that sort of liberal viewpoint's under attack. And in a way, let's all come together and laugh about how, we do fulfil certain cliches about our tastes and our wishy-washy opinions and our hypocrisy, but I sort of think it's better than the alternative, you know. So in a way, it's like inclusion. And hopefully that comes out in the book. The other thing that I think is sort of the kamikaze element in that is that a lot of the columns I'm explicit about the fact that I'm in a hotel room in Sheffield on Thursday night.
Trying to write the column.
And the news has just changed. And I don't know what to do. And I talk about, if I were to take this point of view, I could do this. And again, I think I've probably got that from Machen, who, you know, one of my favourite books of his is The London Adventure, which is a sort of book where he states at the front that he's been given a small amount of money to write a book. And then he proceeds to write that book in front of you. And it's sort of a bit like someone just wandering around going, oh, there's a fucking app I'll write about this. Sort of, and by the end of it, the space has been sort of filled up. There's that other famous French surrealist one, the voyage around my bedroom, you know, with a guy just, instead of a journey around the world, it's just a description of everything in his room. You know, sort of. You know, so in a way, they're little exercises like that that are self-aware in the same way that the stand-up's self-aware.
Yeah.
But again, I wonder a lot of stuff. I wonder if you get it from being lucky enough to read 60s and 70s Marvel comics where, you know, Stan Lee's editorials introduced him as a kind of character that sort of this was explicit about the fact that they were generating all this stuff and it didn't come from nowhere. And that, you know, do you know what I mean? There's a sort of funny self-awareness about that period.
Well, yeah. I mean, like, I was reading a piece by David Foster Wallace the other day where he was talking about television.
Right.
And he was saying that actually it's very difficult to satirise television because television has been satirising and referring to itself for decades.
Yeah.
Television is kind of obsessed with television.
Well, the last person to do that, I think, was, and it was after I'd stopped being involved with them, but was the day-to-day team.
Mm-hmm.
But in the mid-90s, who satirised the production, the production values of television and the thinking behind it, to the point where it actually seemed to give it a new lease of life, because it assimilated all those criticisms, and then their graphics became sort of Sky News graphics in the same way as, you know, your attempts to what appeared like full stops to certain genres of comics actually gave loads of people a new set of tools to work with. Creating
the irony's not lost upon me.
Creating sort of the last thing you would have wanted to go. Yeah. If you go the logical endpoint of these comics is sort of mad fascist ultra-violence, that doesn't mean you then do it for 20 years afterwards.
This is it. When I was watching things like The Day to Day, the graphics, which called attention to how nonsensical the graphics were upon all television. But then to think, this is a really great way of doing graphics, let's make them more like this.
Well, actually, what I started thinking about in this, again, was how one of the problems I have writing for papers, and I don't even write for The Guardian if they ask me, because I worry about what headline they'll put on it. And even if they give you copy approval, sometimes things happen with photos and captions that land you in hot water. You know, I've got in trouble a couple of times where I've written about some contentious issue and I've said, can I have copy approval? They've gone, yeah, fine. Then the headline, the Sunday Times did this once, it was really bad. The headline changes or condenses what you've said to the point where you're misrepresented, to the point where it's almost actionable, you know. And so but then I realised that could sort of happen with this, and I started to work with the copy editors and say, for this, let's come up with a headline that misrepresents the piece. And then I'll write in the piece about how I hope they don't put a headline.
Headline.
And then there is one.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's sort of, so you start to think about that.
That's probably an intelligent way of dealing with the fact that you will always get misrepresentative headlines.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they let me have a look at them now. But then I started to sort of think, actually, what would be the worst possible headline you could put on this from which the piece could never recover? And sometimes we would do that to sort of sabotage it and then see what it then read like.
Yeah.
And it also proves that lots of people only read the headline and then slag you off for that, even if you've put in the body of the work. I don't choose the headlines. I hope they don't make the headline, "I am the new Christ," says Stuart Lee, which is what I thought was wrong. Because that would be to miss it, but then that is the headline.
You'd assume reading it, there must have been some
dialogue, presumably, between the sub-editor and the...
It's what you were saying about, like, the, what was it, 23 million a week that would be going to the NHS rather 350 than...
350 million.
350
yeah,
million.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. That these things were flat lies.
Yeah, yeah.
And yet, that doesn't appear to matter.
No.
It doesn't appear to matter that we've apparently made this momentous decision based upon completely false information.
Yeah.
It's. I think that we might be approaching some sort of crisis.
A crisis of the perception of information.
Yeah.
You know, because a lot of things now you write about. There's a couple about environmental things, where you start with the science and then extrapolate it out, have a bit of fun about what will the extra London runway mean, what I mean. But if we're in this thing where the word experts become a pejorative term, you know, how do you use the findings of experts as a building block towards a joke or a funny essay if we're now being asked to just, we don't even have to listen to that? It's sort of, again, it's an interesting time to be trying to do stuff, because I don't quite know how you would do this now after that. It's a weird time.
Well, you kind of have to have a kind of stable baseline to actually react to.
Yeah.
But the baseline is oscillating all over
daily.
The place. Yeah,
yeah,
daily, by the hour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there was a lot of times, actually, and it's also about the speed of news. I mean, 2011, when this collection starts, feels like a long time ago compared to the news speed of 2016, whereas a couple of times where I was supposed to be doing things for The Observer, it's got to Friday, it's 10 o'clock, I've filed it, and something has happened that has made it absolutely irrelevant or tasteless. Because but previously, people would have read something and thought, well, he must have filed that before that happened. But now there's this sort of assumption that everything is instantly generated, because often by the time you pick up a newspaper, the front page is wrong because of rolling news overnight. It's difficult trying to... It's much more difficult now than it was 5 years ago to write a sort of broadly true thing, because in the space of the time window you're allowed to do them.
When I was at my last most recent Arts Lab meeting
on
Thursday night, there was a guy who hadn't been around for a couple of weeks. I think he'd been on holiday, and we were saying Theresa May is now the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson is now the Foreign Secretary, and he thought we were joking for quite a What a while.
It's like that Ray Bradbury story where the bloke goes back in time and steps on a butterfly.
And he comes back and everybody's got three eyes and are speaking Polish.
Yeah, you can't understand. Though it's, yeah, I mean, it's funny, but the discipline of doing it is funny. Like the Wednesday, you know, what are you going to do? I'll try this. And then having 48 hours to do it. And I initially used to really worry about it and be awake for 48 hours. And then I got into this habit where I almost sort of wrote them in character. I drop the kids off at school, think, right, I'm going to do this in 7 hours, 6 hours, whatever, because that's sort of what a hack writer would do.
Yeah.
Because they'd have to hit their deadline, and they can't spend all week doing it because they've got to do other jobs. So I sort of tried to think like that, and in the end, you have to kind of leave it and do what you've got. And that again felt a bit like going backwards to when I started writing, where you didn't have your laptop and you weren't able to make corrections via email, and you had to fax the thing in. And
yeah.
You know, I was talking to Dan Abnett about that, you know, about when he first started writing comics in the 80s, about having to fax, getting artwork faxed from America, and it taking ages to come through. And now it just seems amazing. I assume they probably go to some online dump where they kind of collaborate across the
I think that I'm rapidly losing touch with how it all works, yeah. But I believe that there's relatively few artists, yeah, like say Kevin O'Neill, who actually still produce physical artwork.
So
it's all completely changed.
Yeah.
It's but the thing is that the rate of change itself is changing,
yeah,
and accelerating. And the thing is that I think that this is a problem for everything.
Yeah.
There's this mounting complexity.
Yeah.
And we couldn't even handle our previous levels of complexity.
Yeah.
But sort of yeah, and it's all so much faster.
Well, the other thing is that interesting how context changes everything. Like all these bits are online somewhere, attached to the publications that they were in. But you put them together in a book, and that asks you to sort of consider it in a way that you wouldn't as individual pieces. And changing the context changes the perception of it. Like, it does feel like the character of the writer gets more mad over the 5 years, as does the level of madness from the public commenting on things. And in isolation, they don't see that, and that's sort of what digital media has done to us. We see a succession of things in isolation rather than as a assembled whole. So in a way, it is nice to put all those back into a book, because it accidentally creates an arc that follows 5 years of what's going on.
And it becomes a kind of a graph for the decline of culture.
The decline of me. Yeah. Well, it's been an interesting opportunity to do it, and I hope that it carries on, because creatively it's an interesting time. It's interesting to solve the problem of how to write about now, but at the moment I don't have a clue, and the new stand-up set is in free fall for the same reason. Luckily I haven't got to give it. It doesn't have to get reviewed till November, and hopefully by then things will be a bit more clear. But at the moment it's like peering into the mist. But I think the exercise of trying to make sense of it.
I suppose
fun.
Particularly in what you were saying about having to make sense of something.
Yeah.
On a deadline.
Yeah.
In a hotel.
Yeah.
That is probably the only way that we can.
Yeah.
Make sense of things, just to kind of grab stuff out of the air. Well, with a deadline approaching, and put something down.
Okay, well, you've just written the longest work of fiction that's been published, haven't you?
I don't know about that.
Right. But it's certainly...
I mean, I think that the Bible... Is that a work of fiction? Is it all right to say that? I think that's longest,
Lord. Yeah, well, that's... I was about to say the Bible's the work of many hands and your Jerusalem novel isn't, but... We also assume the Bible is on some level the work of one mind, dictating. So that's the... You're not...
Yeah, yeah.
But, okay, with that then, Did you impose yourself a deadline to finish it? Because I don't think I could do something like that without deadlines. And the deadlines for these have been really good. And I've accidentally created a thing from a succession of deadlines.
I didn't impose a deadline, but luckily, because I've got no idea how long it was going to take me. One thing that I have found since the referendum and things like that is that, I mean, if you can think back to the world as it existed before June the 23rd or whatever it was, then none of us expected this to happen. And we were all just doing our satirical or fictional pieces. And then this happened, and strangely, a lot of things that I know were being prepared a long time before this occurred suddenly seem to be almost prophetic. Ben Wheatley's High Rise. Or stuff like that. It doesn't look anywhere near as strange and dystopian as it might have done a few months ago.
Maybe because if you're writing, you have to intuit on some level what's going on, so you intuit the public mood, and the public mood has spoken, you know. So it's interesting. It's interesting times. I mean, I don't know what voice the character writing comic writing those would have now. I don't know, because I don't know what his relationship is in opposition to, you know, the majority of public opinion. I don't really know where it goes now. When's the Jerusalem out?
Jerusalem, that will be out, I believe, from Knockabout in September, costing £25. And it's about 1,300 pages, and like 25, how much does this cost? Let's have a look. Well, this doesn't have a price on it, but I bet that mine's probably
much
better value.
Page for page. Oh, definitely, it's much better value, page for page. Just in terms of the amount of content provided.
You do have to provide content.
Yeah, well, that's, at the end of the day, they can take away, the delivery mechanism, and they can, but at the end of the day, there's some people are always going to want content provided. In France, recently, there's a place we go to with the kids, high up in the mountains, where a little shop makes some rose petal ice cream. It's worth a drive through the Pyrenees once a year for rose petal ice cream. And we queued up this year as usual, and the man recognised my wife and said, "Ah, Brexit, no rose petal ice cream for you." And at the end of the day, right, whatever happens politically, you've got stuff people want. They'll always need content provided.
They will always need content provided.
That's like a good, if that was proper radio or telly, that would, people would, in the gallery would go, "Oh, you've wound that up beautifully."
I was just about to do that.